From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine has shocked and alarmed the world. As at the time of this podcast, Ukraine was mounting strong resistance, but Russia has overwhelming force. The West has imposed tough and comprehensive sanctions, which will put a high price on Russia for its aggression. Western countries are helping Ukraine with military equipment, and Australia is sending funds for weaponry. NATO has reinforced the military forces on its eastern front, but it has been adamant that it won't send troops to assist Ukraine. Matthew Sussex is Associate Professor at the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University and an expert on Russia, and he joins us today. Matthew Sussex, let's start at the beginning. What are the origins of this war? Why did President Putin think Ukraine mattered to the extent of mounting an invasion which is going to bring economic and other mayhem for Russia?
Well, there are two things going on here. The first thing is how Russia perceives its sort of geopolitical position in Europe and in Asia. For a long time, Putin and even Yeltsin before him have made the charge that the West is creeping ever closer to Russia's borders by expanding NATO, by moving its military structures towards Russia, and saying effectively, Russia can't join, Russia must be out. So therefore, there's a perception in Russia, and there has been for a very long time, that the West not only doesn't trust it, but actively seeks to undermine it. That, I think, has been played up very much by Putin and turned into a sort of nationalist myth. You know, this idea of the evil West, who's responsible for pretty much all of the ills that Russia might face. And Ukraine has become very much the battleground in all this. Putin has, since 2013 and the Euromaidan revolution that got rid of the pro-Russian president, Yanukovych, who was forced to flee, Putin has basically said that Ukraine is run by fascists. It's run by neo-Nazis who are in league with NATO and in league with the US, and they pose a real existential threat to Russia. So that's the one side. The other side is that Putin himself seems absolutely personally invested in recreating the footprint, at least, of the USSR, certainly not its ideology, but its footprint. He has for a long time said that Ukraine doesn't deserve to exist as a state, that Ukrainians and Russians are just one people driven apart by the West, and that basically Ukrainians have no identity and no sovereignty. So he has, achieved some of his aims already, I think, in terms of Belarus, another part of what Putin sees as a greater Russia, extending the Kremlin's influence there. And I think Ukraine is very much the sort of battleground of ideas, but also the battleground of geopolitics when it comes to Putin versus the West and Putin and his desire to make Russia great again.
Well, if he's going to pursue the footprint of the old Soviet Union, then that's very threatening for a number of other countries, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Russian military forces have been staging provocations against the Baltic states, Estonia in particular, violating their airspace on regular occasions, often up to about 200 times a year, forcing NATO planes to scramble. And the worry is, of course, that if Putin gets what he wants in Ukraine, then he will not stop. He will then turn his eyes to Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, possibly even Poland will be told in a few years' time that it doesn't have the right to exist as a sovereign state.
And at some point, presumably, the Western countries would have to say enough's enough.
I think probably we've seen, not with military action, of course, but we've certainly seen that happen on the sort of economic warfare front and the exclusion of Russia through the very robust response of the European Union and by the United States. And the extent of it was really not something that most experts were expecting. Most experts were expecting, and I think probably Putin was too, that the West was going to do what it had done for years, which is kick the Russia can down the road and see it as a problem that they hope would go away with some tokenistic sanctions. And that clearly hasn't happened here. So the one thing we've seen out of this is very much the strengthening of Western resolve. Whether it's enough to deter Putin, I have my doubts. But it will certainly punish him and punish those who are close to him, as well as, unfortunately, ordinary Russians who really don't want this war.
But if he tried to expand into these other countries, wouldn't that necessarily mean that the West had to draw the line?
Absolutely. If and Biden and other NATO leaders have been quite unequivocal on this, that they will defend every square inch of NATO soil. Under Article 5, an attack against one is an attack against all. So clearly putting Putin on notice that while they may not intervene or will not intervene militarily in Ukraine, any further steps towards the West will be met with force. Whether Putin decides to test that is something we're going to have to wait and see.
Now, you've talked about how Putin sees the world and Russia's position. Are any of his grievances legitimate?
Look, I think, and I'm someone who has been watching Russia for about 25 years now. I used to very much agree with the idea that NATO and the West treated Russia roughly or with indifference. Certainly in the 1990s, NATO said, well, we are a collective security organization. Everyone is free to join. But clearly, Russia was not free to join. And this was a time of enormous economic upheaval in the Russian Federation. People's livelihoods were completely ruined by the Asian financial crisis. And progressive bailouts by the IMF went into the pockets of oligarchs. So I think both in the initial phases, NATO could have done more and the West could have done more to accommodate Russian differences. It frankly, I think, was flawed for doing that. It was a bad policy choice. However, I think since Putin has turned this into a real sort of ultra-nationalist even aspect of Russian identity and Russia's conception of itself, I think those arguments have become less viable. It's certainly not the case that NATO threatens Russian security and Ukraine doesn't threaten Russian security, given that Russia has 6,500 nuclear warheads, more nukes than anyone on the face of the earth. I think what they do fear and what Putin does himself fears is he fears the ideas that come along with NATO and a pro-Western approach. So it's more of a threat, I think, to the regime of Putin than the Russian state necessarily.
Just before we get on to that, you mentioned Russia's nuclear arsenal. What's the significance of Putin upgrading its stance in the last few days, its nuclear stance? Is it possible that it could use a nuclear weapon against Ukraine?
I think it's less likely that Russia would use a nuclear weapon against Ukraine. It would have to be a tactical nuclear weapon, a smaller one. What he's done is effectively put his strategic nuclear forces on heightened state of alert. Now, they're on a heightened state of alert anyway, so there isn't a huge difference between announcing you're doing it and actually doing it in the first place. So the word out of the Pentagon has been that they haven't seen anything different in terms of Russia's nuclear posture. So the point of this was to send a very clear signal to the West, I think, that any intervention by the West would be met with escalation. The Russians have a military doctrine that sort of tries to encompass this. It's known as escalate to de-escalate, that you push in hard and as far as you can in order to get the other side to back down. So effectively, it's a psychological bargaining tactic, I think, by Putin. But that doesn't mean that there can't be mistakes and misperceptions and accidents, which makes it a very dangerous time.
You referred to the sanctions being really tough, tougher than Russia might have anticipated. What will be the impact on Russia of these sanctions? Will they cripple the economy, the financial system? Can Russia stand out against them in any way?
Well, Russia has about $620 US billion dollars worth of sovereign wealth fund, which it's been building up over years in order to cushion itself from harsh Western sanctions. And theoretically, that could allow Moscow to ride it out for about very tough sanctions out for about a year. But that money isn't in Russia. Most of it is, in fact, in G7 nations. So it is vulnerable to asset freezes. And a lot of that money, too, is where Russia's oligarchs and its rumored Putin himself has his cash. Now, the United States is talking not just about freezing the assets of the Russian central bank, but also seizing them overseas. And that's an enormous amount of money that Russia wouldn't be able to call on. Other types of sanctions, of course, are things like export controls, crippling Russia's tech sector and its aerospace sector. It's going to be very, very hard, put simply, for Russia to be able to do any kind of business whatsoever in the West. And that's not just Europe. It's not just the United States. It's also places like Japan. So realistically, I think it is going to hurt Russian people. We've already seen a run on ATMs in Russia where people are desperately trying to get out cash. The ruble has dropped in value by 30%. It really is going to put the hurt on the Russian economy as well as those who are close to Putin's inner circle and Putin himself.
So what will be the implications, do you think, for Putin's own political fortunes? Will there be a backlash? We've seen demonstrations in Russia, something that we haven't seen so much in the past. And what about those close to him? Are they going to remain supportive of all this?
Well, Russian public opinion, of course, is fed a steady diet of nationalistic bombast. So Russians, for their official news, are told that this is something that they're going to have to endure. It's not Putin's fault. But the fact, of course, that we've seen people come out in, for Russia at least, sizable numbers and get arrested is really quite significant, because the risks of protesting in Russia are huge. Not only do you face arrest and detention without trial, you face the potential of being beaten up, you face the potential of you losing your job, your income, your access to schooling for your children, access to childcare. So there are really, really hefty punishments that can be used by the Russian state. I think that's, you know, a powerful reason why we haven't seen even stronger demonstrations. The longer this goes on, the more likely you will see popular discontent rising. Interest rates, for instance, have gone from 9.5% to 20% overnight, and that's going to put a lot of hurt on people. Putin himself is very fearful of popular uprisings. He's made no secret of that. He's also obsessed with what happened to Gaddafi. He doesn't want to be dragged out of the palace and basically gotten rid of by the people. So that's something that will happen, I think, or at least the impetus towards it will increase, but that'll take a considerable amount of time. More in the short term is what his oligarchs and inner circle start saying. It's worth remembering, I think, that these people are terrified of Vladimir Putin. He has played divide and rule with them for many, many years. And they don't see, removing him as something that is viable yet. However, in a couple of months, if they are completely unable to access their vast fortunes, there may well be more than just rumblings of discontent within the Kremlin inner circle. And it may well be that they start thinking about, well, is it time to think about a successor to Putin? Not because they're liberals, not because they're Democrats. Those types of people do not exist in Russia anymore, but because simply of the desire to protect the enormous amounts of wealth that they've amassed during Putin's rule.
And how do you read China's position in this conflict? It's called for restraint, and yet it hasn't come out hard against Russia's action, and it liberalised the trade in wheat recently. How is it reading the situation?
Well, China is very interesting because, of course, just before the invasion of Ukraine, China and Russia signed a sort of statement about how they were united about against the West and reject the Western hegemony, made references to Taiwan, but interestingly not Ukraine. And then, of course, the invasion happens. So for the Chinese, it puts them in a delicate position. There is some suggestion that Chinese elites are not happy with the direction that the war is taking, Putin getting bogged down in Ukraine. They actually weren't very happy with the invasion of Crimea in 2014 because that contradicted the principle of non-intervention that the Chinese place much store by in their public rhetoric. Having Russia effectively continue to intervene in the affairs of countries around it really undercuts the Chinese narrative. And there have been some very subtle signs, and they're always subtle, coming out of Beijing, that China is sort of mulling its options. There was one statement, for instance, from the foreign ministry, which said that China and Russia are partners, but they are by no means aligned, and that China calls on, you know, all parties to end hostilities. Added to that, Chinese TV is now also starting to show Zelensky's speeches from the Ukraine and pictures of some of the damage in Ukraine. So that might be first subtle signs that the Chinese may be willing to put some pressure on Moscow in order to stop the bad images from tainting its own position.
And are there back channels of discussion, do you think? You mentioned the signs, but do you think this is translating into actual pressure at the moment, or is this just potential pressure?
I think at the moment is probably potential pressure. There are, of course, many, many back channels for this type of message to be communicated to the Kremlin. The question is whether Putin is actually listening. You'd think that probably the PRC is about the only country that might be able to get him to step back, because it will be China that will be bankrolling the Russian Federation for probably about the next 15 years, if, of course, Putin remains in power. That's because Russia simply won't be able to get any investment in its energy sector, which it vitally needs for its economy. So that is significant leverage that the Chinese have. It may be, of course, that Putin is not prepared to listen, that he's ultimately decided to resolve the European security question for once and for all, the thing he's been unhappy about since 1991, and will press ahead regardless. And if that's the case, if Putin is not susceptible to pressure, then we are entering a really, really dangerous phase of this conflict.
Now, coming back to the war itself on the ground, how do you see this unfolding in coming days? How long can Ukraine hold out?
Well, the Russians have reverted to their typical playbook when it comes to, offensive military operations. And that is to try and cut off and capture enemy troops, to kettle them, basically. And then to lay siege to cities and to use some quite horrendous, completely unguided artillery, multiple missiles, thermobaric weapons, which can level entire city blocks. And that's done in order to sow fear, to make the population cowed and to force the enemy to surrender. I think this is what we're starting to witness, and the next 72 hours will see, unfortunately, a real uptick in the human tragedy in terms of civilian lives and damage to Ukrainian infrastructure and buildings. It's going to be really nasty. How long Ukraine can hold out will depend on how much its remaining armed forces are able to blunt the Russian assault and survive it. At the very least, I think what Putin has done is absolutely guaranteed that even if he wins in the classical sense, there will be a Ukrainian resistance for a very long time, and a very vigorous resistance at that.
So far, the West has maintained a united front in response. Will it be able to continue to do that?
I think that while Putin continues to rattle the nuclear saber, I think that while we see images of unguided missiles hitting population centres, and while the Russian government continues to issue all manner of different threats against Ukraine and the West, I think that it will remain united. I think it's actually been quite galvanizing. Germany, for instance, has reversed 30 years of foreign policy thinking that you can change Russia through trade, and is spending 100 billion euros more on its military. Its population backs that vigorously. You have the potential that Sweden and also Finland will join the NATO alliance. It's quite extraordinary that perhaps the thing that Putin has brought about is the very strengthening of the type of organization that he resented so much in the form of NATO, and also witnessing the birth of the European Union as a really proper security actor. So I think for the moment, the Western response will remain firm. If there is some kind of move towards negotiations and a negotiated settlement, it may be that you will get some wavering in Paris, for instance, and other capitals in the EU, such as Rome. But for the moment, I think it does remain pretty united, which is one of the big surprises of this episode.
And what's the outlook for the energy supplies to Western Europe from Russia? And indeed, what will be the implications of imposing these sanctions for the West and the wider world?
Well, if the Russians respond with energy diplomacy weaponized energy by turning off the gas tap, then it will have a significant impact on Germany. It'll have a significant impact on Italy. Some of the other EU states as well, even on places like Poland. So the search for diversification away from Russian gas will be a matter of absolute urgency. The need to get gas supplies that are reliable, that don't come from Russia. It's interesting that in the first phase of the conflict, one of the things the Germans did was to stop the certification of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that they had created with Russia, running direct under sea to Germany. Now, the Nord Stream 2 company has filed for bankruptcy. It is the case, I think, that Germany has decided to completely wean itself from Russian gas. That's going to be painful.
Is Russia likely to turn off that supply?
I think it may well be likely. It has certainly threatened to do it in the past, and has done so. In the past, Putin has done it to Belarus and he's done it to Ukraine. He is certainly one of the weapons he has left in his arsenal.
And what about the wider effect of sanctions on the West?
The wider effect of sanctions, the Russians really, apart from energy sales, don't participate hugely in the European economy. It comprises the absolute bulk of what they sell. Other things that they can do is reduce supply of strategic minerals, which in fact it does export around the world. So that will have implications for countries that can provide them. Even Australia has been floated, for instance, as a nation that could potentially fill some of the gap when it comes to gas. Now, there's no way we can meet demand in the short term, but it may be a long-term prospect if, in fact, the crisis with Russia drags on and on and on, which it looks likely to do.
So that would be a positive for Australia, right? But are there any negatives for Australia in terms of the economic situation?
Australia is fairly well insulated from what Russia might be able to do to it because we're economic competitors. We try and trade the same things. So we try and sell natural gas. The Russians try and sell natural gas. We sell oil, so do the Russians. We sell wheat, so do the Russians. So there are few areas in which Russia could seriously hurt the Australian economy. We're fairly insulated from that. Where it becomes more problematic is when there are knock-on effects that affect supply chains and that might affect other markets. And frankly, China has a big role to play here, that if China decides to throw itself in terms of economic warfare on the Russian side, then that will potentially have severe implications for Australia. But at the moment, there's no sign that it will do that. It most likely to try and play this middle road of saying that conflict should end, that negotiations should happen, that there should be diplomacy and there should be stability. So I would not be too concerned as of yet with the kind of economic fallout for Australia in particular.
The Ukrainian president has called for his country to be admitted to the EU. Now, presumably this might be completely overtaken by events as the Russians get a grip on Ukraine. But how would that play out?
It's interesting that the European Parliament just voted overnight to endorse Ukraine's application for membership in the EU. 600 and something MEPs voting in favour and only 13 or 15 against. Very, very small number. So at least it's symbolic. There is a very, very long process for EU membership and accession to the EU. There are all sorts of hurdles that have to be passed in terms of not just democracy and civil society, but also the way that accounting systems work, where money is stored and so forth. So it would be, I think, quite a long process for Ukraine, even if somehow it were to triumph against Russia, to become an EU member anytime soon.
But the request has been received sympathetically.
Certainly has. The European Parliament has endorsed Ukraine's bid for membership and overwhelmingly endorsed it. Many, many members of the European Parliament coming out in support of that.
And that's just happened.
That it just happened overnight, yes. So that is the very first step. There are lots and lots and lots of potential roadblocks to be overcome. And, of course, there's the conflict to be overcome, because you can't be a European Union member if you have conflict on your territory.
Now, just finally, are there any circumstances in which this conflict could escalate into a wider war?
Absolutely. It is potentially the case that Putin, who is a gambler, will try and up the ante by staging some kind of demonstration of strength against NATO, or perhaps even a provocation directly against NATO troops. Many, many wars in history have been started by accident, by overconfidence, by miscalculation. And this is why it's a very, very dangerous time. It is absolutely not out of the question that NATO may, in fact, come to blows with the Russian armed forces as a result of something like that. Probably not over Ukraine itself, but probably over an attempt by a desperate Putin to bring NATO into the conflict and generate a wider war. Ultimately, that will be counterproductive for Russia because Putin would probably lose that conflict. But nonetheless, it tests the West's appetite for escalation, particularly if it comes with more nuclear saber rattling. That may be a bridge too far for some NATO members to stomach.
Well, on that dark note, we end this podcast. Thank you very much for talking with us, Matthew Sussex, and we'll be back with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. That's all for now. Goodbye to everyone.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.